My name, I'm going to take you through irrigated agriculture, specifically a case study of Kenya and Uganda. You are all aware that what is happening now is actually forcing many countries to find a way of increasing their productivity, especially to do with climate change, because in irrigated agriculture, we are able to grow crops under a controlled environment. And therefore, provided you have water, you can actually be able to have some reasonable yields throughout the year. So we are looking at the water, energy, and food. This basically has increased some attention in various communities, because of the security that goes with the three, that is water, the energy, and the food aspects. And under this nexus, we are basically trying to link the three. We are connecting the three and trying to see how each one of them complements to one another. This is a better explanation of the nexus. I know Tula had taken us through this, so I think you will have it. You will have an opportunity to look at it further. But however, let's remind ourselves here that the nexus perspective can help to address the interdependence of food, water, and energy so as to achieve some sustainable economic growth. Sustainability is one element that developing countries are struggling about. I did mention to, I think, the two of you who were here last week, my own government up to last week had come up with a system that was not sustainable. Luckily enough, this week it was stopped. Our main staple food is maize. You also call it corn. Unfortunately, we are not able to produce enough for ourselves. And therefore, we normally import. And most of that maize is grown under subsidy. The government has kind of reduced on the cost of inputs so that a farmer can realize some reasonable margins and also help a farmer buy enough input so that we can have a good yield. So the subsidy was kind of shelved. And then I did mention that we also had an attack by a locust. So the yields weren't good at all. However, we had some good, reasonable yields, and we were able to exhaust that. So what happened? The price of flour, 2 kgs, shot to almost double. It's not almost double, it's more than double. So the government decided to subsidize the price of flour from an equivalent of about $2.2 to slightly less than $1. That has lasted for about just a week or two. They've had to do away with it. We don't want to believe that it was politics, but we are tempted to suspect that it was politics, probably. So this, again, Tula had talked about it. Now, we are saying that water, environment, and food is basically central to sustainable development because we have the demand for the three increasing with the population. If you look at the population of our countries, they are kind of increasing. And if you look at the growth in agricultural production, it is not growing at the same rate as the population grow. So what that simply means is that you will continuously have a deficit. And with the impacts of climate change, when we normally experience very bad droughts, we are not able to sustain our production systems because of such challenges. And the whole idea is that we must support our government to break that cyclic event. We must try as much as possible to produce enough that can be able to feed the whole nation. This is not specific to our country alone. There are quite a number of countries in the world that are struggling to feed their population. Some don't even get that food at the correct price. Whatever they are getting is a bit more expensive. So the other characteristic that we are facing is water scarcity. We don't have enough water even to use at domestic household level. So if you don't have water to cook, to wash your clothes, how possible is it that you'll be able to have enough water to be able to produce food, to do some irrigation? But somehow, life has to continue. So, and since life has to continue, the model that the Kenya government is using, which is not very sustainable again, is importing water in form of virtue water. By importing food, say from Ukraine, if you do the water footprint, then it simply means that you are importing water from Ukraine, from Russia. So water shortage is a big problem, and we need, other than just water for domestic use, we need that water for industrial use. We also need it for environmental needs. And our Water Resources Management Authority, the body that is in charge of managing all the waters in our country. Let me say that the water sources in the country belong to the Water Resources Authority. We've been drilling boreholes in various parts of the country. One of the things that we normally do is that, and that is according to the guidelines from Water Resources Authority, when you have the yield of a borehole, you are only allowed to abstract 70% of the yield of the borehole. So if the borehole has a yield of 10 cubic meters per hour, for sustainability, you can only be able to abstract 7 cubic meters per hour. And I like our participant from China, who then went to Germany, because she didn't mention yesterday that she was working somewhere and doing environmental impact assessment. So when you're doing an environmental impact assessment, that is one of the things that you have to balance. You have to ensure that your development will not affect the future generation, and therefore you leave some water for environmental flows. So most countries are suffering from water scarcity, and this involves water stress, water shortages, water deficit. It is a crisis. In the capital city of Nairobi, whatever we have is not enough, and you're going to see it. How about in some of those arid and semi-arid areas of Kenya? Again, it is the same problem. We don't have enough water in those areas. And as I did say, we have to find a way of ensuring that we produce enough so that people don't starve. Just the needs of water, recreation, industrial, agricultural, etc., the various demands. Some facts. We have had an increase of production of between 100 to 400% in some parts, some regions of the world through irrigation. So if you can increase your production from 1 to 4, then it is good for you to practice, to put in place the measures that you used in order for you to realize the production. And in this particular case, irrigation has actually been one of the methods as reported by Food and Agriculture Organization in 2006. So this means that we have to invest heavily in irrigation development so that we can enhance our irrigated agriculture. Now, the most unfortunate thing is that most of the fresh water, and we are told about 60% of the world fresh water, is diverted for agriculture. And remember, I did mention that we don't have enough at domestic household level. So what is happening is that there is demand at household level. There is also demand for agriculture. So how do you balance? It is something that we keep debating about. So what do we normally do in Kenya? In arid and semi-arid areas, we have designed and constructed some facilities that help us retain water for a given period of time. And these facilities are basically the rainwater harvesting structures. We do dams, we do water ponds, we do shallow ponds. We also do what we call infiltration galleries. There are some areas in northern Kenya whereby the area is a bit sandy. So we create some holes in that area. And then when it rains, the runoff is trapped and it infiltrates into the ground. And through hydraulic modeling, we are able to tell that this water will take about a year to get to a given point. So there are shallow wells at the tail end of that, what we are calling a catchment with infiltration galleries. This has helped. And that's why you will find that during the dry spells, women, children kind of abstract water from sand. Yeah. That is just enough to help them eke a living. Of course, that cannot be enough for irrigation. And therefore, for irrigation, if we want to do, say, a crop like tomato, tomato is a high-valued crop because it gives you good returns, unlike sorghum or maize. And remember, our staple food is maize. So many people will prefer planting maize to planting tomato, just to try to find a way of ensuring that they have enough food during the dry spell. Now, for that particular case, we use water pans. You construct a water pan, say one that can be able to take 50,000 cubic meters. And you are able to set up a small area where you can do irrigation. And because you don't want to use so much energy, and those water pans are generally in a flat area, so you will end up excavating a hole. Yeah, a big hole that can be, say, 150 meters length and a width of around 100 meters, and then you go deep 3.5 meters, so it will give you some volume. Remember, you are excavating that on a flat ground surface using a bulldozer. So how do you abstract that water? You require some energy. Now, if you had to use a diesel or a petrol pump, or you had to connect electricity, you have bills to pay. So what we normally recommend is to have the portable solar pumps. So you have a small solar pump, you use the sun energy, and then you are able to pump. So you'll have your small area for irrigation. It has been successful in some areas. Now, again, there's a challenge to that. Once a farmer discovers that they are successful, they will move to the high-valued crops. And which are these high-valued crops? The flowers. Now we shift from food crop to crops meant for export. So still, you will still not be able to address the food deficit at the household level.
Impermeabilization process.
Allow me, sitting is not very easy, so I'll stand also once in a while. The nature of soils in the country are quite different. So those are some of the things that we normally, studies that we undertake. We do the trial pits so that you can be able to tell the profile. So if the area is sandy, a rainwater harvesting structure will not help you because you'll have everything disappearing. So what we normally do, we look at loamy soils. And then loamy soils, when you are excavating the pond, with the time you'll be able to tell how much you will lose, okay, from the trial pits. So if you calculate and you find that you are losing through infiltration something like even 30%, I will recommend that. The reason being, that will help us to recharge our groundwater aquifer. In some of those areas, arid areas, you'll find that the neighboring boreholes are saline. So the moment you have these water points around a shallow well, not a borehole, a shallow well, you will discover that you are able to manage the salinity. So that is one method that we normally use. The other method that we normally use is we line. We use plastic materials to line the dam liners that we are able to line. The third method is if there is a clay soil in the neighborhood. Yes, you transfer that and then you kind of line your pits. And this is very common in arid and semi-arid areas because we have people with very large herds of animal. One person can be having about 300, and there are quite a number of homesteads. And these animals require water. And they trek even 500 kilometers looking for pasture and water. So if you're able to get water, then you are able to also reduce the trekking distance for the pastoralists. So basically, this is what I was talking about, ensuring food and nutrition security. By availing water, you are able to avoid the fluctuations in the prices of the food. Now, this is a scenario. I always, when I come to Finland, I always enjoy one thing. The population of this country is so small. In fact, the population of the entire Finland is smaller than the population of my capital city, Nairobi. Jokingly, I normally tell people, then my governor in Nairobi is doing a good job. Because if that governor can give us at least some water for, you know, a highly concentrated population in Nairobi. I think when you get time, talk to Tula about Nairobi. She'll tell you, it's not easy to walk. Yeah? And I invite you, all of you, please, when you get time, walk around Nairobi. So, what has been happening? Look at this population. In fact, when I was looking at this thing yesterday, I got surprised that our population before independence was even higher than the population of Finland currently. Imagine. Because look at this. This is 10 million. 10 million. By 1969, we already had 10 million people in Kenya. You noted, all of us told you we have two, isn't it? Two children.
Yeah, yeah.
My father had 21. 21. My late father had 21. Three. And let me tell you one thing. I respect him to death in his grave because he was able to feed us. But of course, I learned something out of it and said, even two, it was war between me and my wife. I had refused. I just wanted one. He was just blessed. Not rich, but blessed. But he was not amongst the rich people in Kenya. No, he was just organized. He was able to bring us up. And my father was very wise. He used to work for the government. So he bought land, and then we had our rural home, and then he was working. So wherever he was with our wife. And he had a timetable. After 2 years, they changed. One of them goes to the rural home, the other one goes to town, and the other one remains in the farm. So to some kind of true stories. So you can see most of us wouldn't want to think. Even marrying the first one was a problem, but that is it. So our current population is threatening to be 60 million people. I really feel sorry for the government because I don't know where we are going to get food to feed the people. And we have different religions in Kenya. Some don't believe in family planning. Totally. Because of their faith. And then we also have the poverty levels are very high in some areas. So what happens? I don't want to use, but the only thing they know is taking care of their children and their animals. So what do? They have to produce, give birth to many children so that some of them can take care of their animals. You see, but I'm happy to say that the government is trying to fight some of those those barbaric traditions so that we can have a system that can be managed, can be fed. Again, this is another very interesting scenario. Look at way back in 1969, our per capita water was in the range of 1,900. Where are we currently? We are somewhere close to 500. And this is in 2010. So I suspect by now we are threatening to hit 300. And yet, who can tell me what is the recommended per capita water requirements per person per day? I mean, per person per year? But not per day, per year. Per capita water requirement. Anybody with an idea?
20 liters was the minimum in the camp per day. So I think that if it is that the minimum, it needs to be 700.
Is 1,000?
Yeah.
1,000. Yeah. And where are we? Where are we currently? This was when? No miracle has happened. In fact, if anything, we're having climate change. So there is already from this, you can actually see that we have a problem. And this is a problem that we are trying to address as a country.
You have more population also.
And the population is also increasing, isn't it? Let's hope that this will not tend towards zero. Because when it tends towards zero, what does that mean? We'll not have anything, isn't it?
Maybe you should consider
birth control, and how about us considering other forms of water? What we need to do as a country is to heavily invest in rainwater harvesting.
Yeah.
That is number one. Number two, we need to protect our catchment. Our forest cover is less than 10%. Okay? And the problem is that people have encroached onto the forest. So what happens is that when it rains, all that water ends up as runoff to the Indian Ocean. So that's why I was telling you, when it rains, we are complaining. The floods are killing us. When it is dry, we are also complaining. So can I conclude that we are a complaining nation? Yeah. Yeah. Let's look at Nairobi, for example. Nairobi City, we require about 1.2 billion liters of water. We'll require that by 2035 because there is this migration, rural-urban migration to the city for people to look for jobs. So this is the kind of water that we'll require by the year 2035. That is from the master plan. The current situation is that we are getting about 580 cubic meters of water on a daily basis. And our target for now is about, say, 750. So if we can have about 750 cubic meters, then you'll have relatively enough water. So there is a project, an ongoing project. We are transferring water from one catchment to another through a tunnel by gravity. It's called the Northern Collector Tunnel. From that Northern Collector Tunnel, we are only able to get 140,000 cubic meters against what we require of about 200. So we still have a long way to go. And that is based on the projection at that time. Remember the other dynamics, like population increase, urbanization, you know. So this is where we are. I did mention that we can improve our food security through irrigated agriculture. However, our water resources are inadequate. So we are considering what we call the virtue water. The term virtue water was first defined in 1998 by Professor Tom Allen. This is the volume of water required for making a product and the water used in the production process. So if you, for example, if you are growing tomatoes, so the entire water that you require to grow the tomatoes, you can calculate it as virtue water, such that if you are importing the tomatoes from Russia, for example, then what it means is that you have imported that water from Russia to your country. Okay? So you alternatively, you could have grown the tomatoes, isn't it? And if you grow the tomatoes, then it means that you're going to use the existing water in your country. So to avoid using the existing water in your country, you can import the tomatoes And then you don't use that water so that you can use that water for something else. So virtue water is the water hidden in the products, services, and processes people buy and use every day. So what we normally do, we do some calculations and calculate what we call the water footprints. And now, yesterday, the other day, when Kairigo was presenting, I think our colleague from China asked a question to, she needed some clarification on the definition of gray water. I decided to add this so that you don't get confused, okay? Don't get confused. Under virtue water, we have the green water, we have the blue water, and then we have the gray water, okay? In our sustainable sanitation systems, we normally talk of black water, gray water, and yellow water. There's also brown water. So for the green water is the moisture from precipitation, mainly rainfall, that is used by the plants. And if you want to calculate it well, use, like for example, you need to calculate how much water is extracted through evapotranspiration by the plant during its growth. So that water, that is what is referred to as the green water. And then we have the blue water. The blue water basically refers to the surface water and the groundwater. So you can easily calculate the footprints of a country in terms of the blue water, in terms of the green water. And then the yellow, the gray water is the polluted water, which is in contact with the fecal matter. Now, here we talk about gray water. It is basically that stream of domestic wastewater that is associated with activities like bathing, laundry, dishwashing, etc. Ideally, in quotes, the gray water is not supposed to have feces, isn't it? Because if it has feces, it becomes black water. But is it possible? It is not possible, because when you are cleaning, washing a child or what, at times, you might end up having some traces of feces. So these waters, like the gray water, can be recycled and used. I saw in Israel a very nice system whereby you have one pipe that clearly is clearly marked with a different color from the recycled water, and it's available in the houses. So you know this is water from the wastewater the treated wastewater. Now, and when we did some analysis, we even discovered that the recycled water was much cleaner than the other pipeline with fresh water. But the question was, who can drink the recycled water? Nobody. So it's mainly used for irrigation. So this is like with my colleague here, who is an architect, we are trying to find a way of incorporating such in our design, so that you can have some houses that can embrace such technology, so that they are able to mount recycling plants and they use that water probably to flush their toilets. And that way you are able to reduce on the demand for clean water. So black water, I think you know about it, I'll skip that. So I've mentioned about the water footprints of our product. So the information is here, green water, footprint, volume of rainwater evaporated. Blue water footprint is the volume of surface water or groundwater evaporated. And then the gray water footprint is the volume of polluted water, etc. So some information there on calculating the footprint. You'll have this slide so you can look at it if you want to, you are more interested in it. So for us to improve our food security, now I go to the core business, we look at the irrigation. Now, irrigation, you apply irrigation when you don't have enough rainfall. So you are bridging a deficit. And we normally measure the deficit by determining two critical points. One, the permanent wilting point, and the field capacity of a soil. In the laboratory, there are very simple methods that we normally use to determine the field capacity of a soil and the permanent wilting point. If you take a sponge in, say, a rectangular shape, and you wet it completely, the sponge is lying in a container. You wet it until the container is full. You will end up having some runoff when it is full, isn't it? Start running off. So at that point, if a miracle can happen and then you lift that sponge and hold it, you will be able to have some water draining, isn't it? That is basically drainage water. And when it drains for, say, 24 hours, the sponge will still be holding some water. Am I right? That, if we weigh the sponge, the initial weight of the sponge without water and the weight of the sponge at that time, that is basically the field capacity of the soil. And that, for plants that are not halophytes, they are not water-loving plants. Rice, for example, is grown in a flooded area, isn't it? So it's a halophyte, it loves water, it can survive. But for most plants, they don't survive in flooded areas. So this field capacity is very important because that is the point at which you're supposed to add water. If you squeeze your sponge, squeeze it, and the best way of squeezing is to dry it in an oven somewhere if possible, you are able to get the difference between field capacity, the moisture field capacity, and what we are calling the wilting point. So those two extremes, field capacity and wilting point, they guide you to irrigate your farm because you are supposed to bring the moisture from field capacity to, from wilting point to field capacity. Now, it is not good for you to allow your moisture in the field to drop to field capacity. You will lose your crops. So what we normally do is we look at that as the total available water, and then we determine a point in between, say take 50% of that, and that becomes the point, your lowest point under which you can allow the moisture to drop. Okay? So anytime that you need to irrigate, once the moisture content drops to that level, you add water back to field capacity. And then you allow the crop to abstract that water for 2 to 3 days again. Next time again, you irrigate. There are ways we calculate that, and you're able to follow the schedule. The beautiful thing about that is that we have sensors. So you can actually be able to automate the whole system such that when the moisture drops, it automatically triggers. Yeah. In Kenya, I normally see the young guys also, they have an app. They can be able to monitor what is happening using their phone, and they can switch it off and switch it off on, or it just, it's automated. You are able to apply. And some very good sensors can even, it are linked to, you have some kind of a rain gauge in your farm, whereby that level of rain is automatically subtracted, such that when you're applying, you just apply the difference. So this is basically what we normally do also to determine our, another way of determining your field capacity and permanent wilting point is to use this. How do you use it? You collect your samples from the field, take them to the lab, and then you determine the percentages of the various soil particles, that is sand, silt, and clay. So provided you have two, you will be able to get a third one. And then you use this soil texture triangle, check the percentages, where they intersect, that is your classification of the soil. So once you have that classification, you can use software, like go to the pedo transfer function, read what you have there, and you'll be able to get that data. So we normally talk about a calculator, an online calculator. So you can use that online calculator to do your computation such that you are able to determine how much you're supposed to irrigate at any given time. So this is just to show you what happens when it rains. You have what goes into the soil, and then you have what gets out as runoff. Of course, when you're doing your irrigation, the other thing that you must always do is to do the infiltration tests. They are very important because when the rainfall intensity is higher than the infiltration rate, what will happen? You'll end up with the runoff. The speed of rain coming in is higher than the speed of water going into the soil. It simply means that you are having more than what the soil can take. Even you as a human being, you're very angry and then you eat very fast, you'll be choked. Same principle. So you'll have the runoff. To avoid that, When you are designing your irrigation system, you balance, do the infiltration test, and you are able to tell, oh, my soil has this particular type of infiltration. So if the soil has this infiltration, then your auto application method can be a sprinkler, it can be a drip. Yeah, you are able to choose your emitter accordingly based on that.
How organic bacteria can affect, because we are talking about sand and seed and clay, but it can organic material act as a buffer to change this, like, temporary. That's why the compost is important.
Yes. I want us to just hold on. There's a slide that talks about that. You've gone ahead of me a little bit. Thank you. So this is basically a graph showing you the field capacity and the wilting point, and then the available water. So I did say that, for example, if your soil is silty loam, so this is the total available water you take at 50%, so you irrigate to bring it back to the field capacity. Good. This is a schematic presentation of the same, just to make you get it a better way. And this is what I was talking about, the sponge. You are able to determine your wilting point and your field capacity based on this simple experiment here. Water distribution and application methods. You can ideally use the gravity system or the pressurized irrigation system. Pressure requires energy. Energy is costly, not unless you have very long sunshine hours, like, for example, in Kenya, where you can integrate a solar system. And gravity, good thing, it flows by gravity, but when you are running, say, a sprinkler irrigation system, say the center pivot, you need a lot of pressure, yeah, for it to rotate. So that becomes a disadvantage to the gravity system, not unless that water is coming from a hill somewhere. But you might also end up having problems with the airlock in the system. So there's quite a lot of balancing that you require to do. So Kenya as a country, we are a water scarce country. And we only have about 80%. And we talk about the physical water scarcity. This is as a result of the inadequate natural water resources. And then we also have what we call the economic water scarcity, which is basically associated with poor management. The economic water scarcity is what we have been trying to fight, so much so that before, I do a lot of irrigation. So before I recommend for a new irrigation scheme, what I want us to do, first of all, is to address the economic issues in the existing irrigation scheme. Because some of those inefficiencies can help us achieve our target by even 10%. So we try to solve the problem first before creating another problem in the name of expansion. We have one irrigation scheme, the Ahero irrigation scheme in Kenya. It is in Western Kenya where we grow rice. Why I picked on this irrigation scheme, and I want to compare it with the Doho irrigation scheme in Uganda. This Ahero irrigation scheme, we are abstracting water from a river, River Nyando. And we are using two electric pumps to pump water to a canal. So it's surface irrigation system, canal. We are pumping that water to slightly less than 8 meters. Of course, it's between 7.8 to 8 meters, depending on the fluctuations of the level in the river. So we are pumping that water to a canal. That canal, half of it is lined. So what you're asking, it is lined with a lining material, so the losses are minimum. And then the remaining part of the main canal is not lined. It is not lined. So you are using money to pump, and then you are losing water through infiltration. It's not very interesting. In the area, the average rainfall is about 630, but it varies between 200 millimeters to 1,800. These are basically the characteristics of the scheme, where it is and what I was talking about. And then I also tried to do some cost of production at that time. Now things have changed a little bit. The major crops grown are basically rice, is the main crop that is grown, but we also have some horticultural crops grown around that place, including maize. The most unfortunate thing is that we plant in one season. So it's irrigation, but it's almost like you rely on rainfall again. So we've been pushing the management to do at least 2 to 3 seasons, if possible. That way, we'll be able to get more yields from the same. This is just information that I talked about, pumping from Nyando River, the seasonal variation of the rivers, etc. And then from the two pumps, let me not dwell on that. This is how it looks like. This is the canal. The area that is not lined, you can see how we are experiencing some losses. And then this water flows by gravity. We spend an approximately 0.8 million to 1.2 million. You can divide this by 120 to be able to tell how many dollars, 120, 130. And then the power requirement is about 120 kilowatts. Not sustainable at all. So we require so much energy to lift this water to between 7 to 8 meters. And then what annoys me about this scheme? The scheme is slightly over 2,000 acres. At the tail end of the scheme, where we have the runoff, there are other farmers who are benefiting from the runoff water. There is another irrigation scheme that is not within the managed area that is benefiting from the excess flow. What does that tell you? We are pumping excess, isn't it? So we are burning fuel. We are burning money, pumping excess water, and this water ends up as runoff. And then from the wisdom of those farmers downstream, they are able to use it and grow rice. So because they are using the runoff, they don't pay for the water. These other farmers have to pay for that water. It's not an interesting scenario. Let's look at Doho Irrigation Scheme. Very interesting. It is also, this is the Doho Irrigation Scheme. Not far from Kenya. This is the western part of Kenya here. So we are neighbors. No wonder we behave the same. We are neighbors here. And Doho Irrigation Scheme is located basically 25 kilometers from the Kenyan border. The most interesting about this particular scheme is that they have a lot of water and their system is purely gravity. So they're not pumping like Kenya. And yet the productivity is low. Productivity here, we are talking about the yields per given unit, say 1 hectare. By the time we are doing this study, when we compare their productivity and the productivity of aero irrigation scheme, our productivity was higher than theirs. And that is why we recommended some measures, which I'm happy they are trying to implement now so that they can improve their productivity. So there's a lot of pressure by the beneficiaries for the Doho irrigation scheme to expand because of excess water. But remember, the expansion and the productivity is low, is not interesting at all. For example, in some areas, they were getting as low as less than 15 bags, 90 kg bags per acre. And from our end, we were hitting about 25. They are both public irrigation schemes, and you can see from this that they are facing some systemic challenges. What we are talking about, there is need generally for a thorough overhaul because the yields, not all the yields could be accounted for. That's why I feel that there is a systemic challenge in the management of that scheme. And then, again, the problem is that the system is totally inefficient. There's a lot of runoff. Water is just flowing. The canals are overgrown with weeds. And for the Kenyan case, much as we are pumping water, there are also some very clever farmers who normally come and bring their animals to the canals to drink water. Because the place is not fenced and there are farmers in the neighborhood. So also from the Kenyan end, we need to address all these challenges so that we can be able to have a very productive venture. So, and occasionally when you try to introduce measures to reform the way these people do their farming, there's always resistance from the farmers. And this is one thing that both governments have been unable to address, because you know, there are always politicians who will always support the farmers. So if you try to address the problem, it becomes political. And political problems are not easy to handle. So this is, we are saying that water scarcity problems is a major surface irrigation problem. Uganda faces water scarcity because of poor management. Kenya faces water scarcity in this case also because of poor management, but the issues are slightly different. But both of them can be helped. So, and for Doho irrigation scheme, we can actually be able to reduce that water to between 50 to 150%. If you reduce that water by that margin, by improving on the efficiencies, then you will still be able to realize the same yields. So what we are saying is, for the Ugandan case, there is enough water. There is even room for expansion, provided you put proper management structures in place. So in one of the benchmarking studies that we conducted to measure the performance of irrigation schemes in Kenya, we found that the public irrigation schemes in Kenya are operating at average performance, and thus the irrigation schemes need to adapt a systematic routine data collection and management to aid in monitoring and evaluation, M&E, right from the pumping. Because if you are able to calibrate and determine the amount of water that you require, then you need to play around with the pumps, use a smaller pump to avoid a situation whereby you are pumping excess that is going to the other farmers. Alternatively, you pump, create another line, pump, have those farmers also integrated in the scheme so that they pay for that water. The issue here is to do with the costs. When we are looking at irrigation performance, we normally subdivided it into at least four. You look at the agricultural performance, the water supply, the delivery, and the economic and environmental aspects, so that you have indicators of the same. And you use those indicators to do your computations, and those computations are able to inform you on how your scheme is performing. And we have a good model that is normally recommended by FAO. It's known as Mascotte. So you use the Mascotte method for analyzing and evaluating different components of the irrigation system in order to develop a modernization plan. So you can use the Mascotte in Uganda, you can use the Mascotte in Kenya, so that you come up with a modernization plan that will be able to address some of these challenges that we are facing. Now, soil conservation measures, I've forgotten your name. I've been with you for 2 weeks and I've forgotten your name. Paula. Paula, this is what you're talking about. We can actually be able to integrate sanitation into our farming by using the byproducts as amendments to the soil. The essence of having those amendments is for you to improve on the water holding capacity of your various soil. So if you have a sandy soil, like what Paula was saying, you can be able to improve that soil by adding amendments. You add organic materials into the soil. Yes, so that you're able to retain that water. And if your soil also is clay-like, you still can add the organic materials so that you improve. You know, clay, when you do an analysis, it cheats you that there's a lot of water in the soil. But the truth of the matter is that water is not available to the plant because of the interconnectivity of the pores. The interconnectivity in clay soils is very poor compared to these other soils. So we are also using the black soldier fly. The black soldier fly, you know, it's a ferocious eater. That fly eats and then it grows. Boop, boop, boop. When it grows, there is the byproduct from the digestion process, whatever you are using, you can actually use it to amend your soil. And then there was, my colleague will talk about energy, biogas. This is a very good way of addressing some of our challenges, because from this organics, you are able to avoid using the chemical fertilizers. In my rural village, we are trying small-scale dairy farming, and I'm the one who is supporting that. The objective is to generate enough manure so that we can use that manure for crop production. And just an area, my mother is old, but very active. I concentrated on just a small area where for the last 2 years I've been dumping manure. And when she planted maize, a miracle happened. And from one, there were two. Some had three cobs. And she got very excited. And I told her, it is because of the manure. We didn't use any fertilizer. So we are embracing that. In fact, when I go back home for the next season, I'm even willing to buy manure from my neighbors so that we improve. Yeah, and somehow that is a bit organic, isn't it? Yeah. Again, the other method that you can be able to use is you use the plastics. You see, the objective is to try, water is scarce. Yeah, but we must continue with farming. So what we normally do, and I've seen it even in so many places, you do plastic mulching. So you try to cover sections of your farm so that you conserve on the little available moisture. This is my last or second last slide. The crisis in Ukraine and Russia has really affected us. And that is why our cost of 50 kg bag has doubled. So it simply means that our cost of production is unbearable. We import a lot of wheat and crude edible oil from Russia and Ukraine. Unfortunately, from what is happening, we were not able to import cooking oil from there. And what happened? The price doubled again. So if you look at these statistics, you see Russia, we import about 67% of wheat from Russia and 22% from Ukraine. And wheat is next to maize because when you prepare, I don't know the correct name for it, but chapati, those who know chapati, those from India, you know how it tastes, isn't it? Please tell the rest what it means to eat chapati. With chicken, eh? Don't forget. So remember that Kenya economy is a commodity market, implying that it generates most of its revenue through commodity exports. And our major exports are coffee, tea, and cut flowers and vegetables. So we are prone to, you know, when there is climate change, be rest assured, we'll be affected. So we need to see what we can do. And currently we are feeling a pinch of the crisis in between Russia and Ukraine.